လူတွေ live recruit တက်ခါမှာလဲသူတို့မရနိုင်တော့ဘူးနောက်ပြီးရှေ့တန်းမှာလဲသူတို့အများကြီးအကြဆုံးတာတွေများတယ်နောက်ပြီး surrender ပေါ့နော်လက်နဲ့ချတာတွေများတယ်နောက်ပြီး defector တွေများတယ်ဆိုတော့လေအဲ့နောက်ပြီးလဲပြီးသူတို့အနေနဲ့ကျွန်မအများအားပြောတာဆိုရင်နေပြီးတော့မှသူတို့ရဲ့တပ်ထင်မှာဆိုသူတို့ရဲ့ဗလဲ soldiers တွေပေါ့နော်ဘယ်နှယောက်ရှိမှသူတို့အသိချာမသိဘူး
twenty-seven မှာကြတော့ပေါ့နော်ဒီဥစ္စာ tipping point ကိုရောက်တယ်လို့ကျွန်မအစားတွေကပြောတာတယ်။ရာတိတိတာတာအဲ့ဒီမှာစပြီးတော့ဒီနေ့တွေ့နေတဲ့ဥစ္စာတွေကလည်းဒီ tipping point ရောက်သွားပြီးတဲ့အတွက်ကြောင့်မလို့ဒီလိုမျိုးကြီးကြီးမားမားတွေပူဖြစ်လာတာလို့ကျွန်မပြောလို့ရပါတယ
်။မင်္ဂလာပါFor any Burmese language speakers tuning in today, we want to let you know that our Better Burma mission has launched three Burmese language podcasts, Myanmar Revolutionary Tales, Dark Era Burma, and Myanmar Peace, Women and Security. These programs can be found on our website as well as on any of your preferred podcast platforms. We invite you to take a listen. But for now, let's get on with this episode.Pleased to be joined again on this episode of Insight Myanmar podcast with Mimi Winbird. Mimi, thanks for sitting down and having another chat with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So the last time we talked, it was in the wake of the devastating 7.7 magnitude earthquake in the Sagaing region. And you referenced your background with the U.S. Army when in the last major natural disaster in Myanmar, Cyclone Nargis in 2008, and used that as a reference point for looking at the recent earthquake. But this time we're checking in with you about a range of other topics. So we're excited to get into that with you. And the first of those is a topic that you brought up where we begin to examine this issue of morale. And morale can mean things in daily life, certainly, but it also has a very specific kind of connotation when you're talking about leading men into battle. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you could first start by breaking down what is morale, why is it important, and then get into the role it's playing in this particular conflict.
Yeah. When you are leading troops, you know, morale is something that we have to pay a lot of attention to. You know, the morale can make or break, you know, your team's performance. And so when you have a very highly motivated soldier, you know, who you will have to ask at some point in time to put down his life, you know, for the mission or for the country, for the, you know, his buddies, right? So that will to fight, that morale is really one of the key factors as a soldier, you know, as a military unit. We are taught to how do you keep your troops' morale up, and teamwork, empathy, taking care of your soldier. We always say people first, mission always, because people, you know, soldiering is a people business. Mm-hmm. It really is a behind every weapon. There's a, you know, human being, whether it be pulling the trigger or directing it, right? Controlling it, making a decision whether to, you know, use it or not to use it, right? That human beings is always related to their mindset, their morale. So that's why in soldiering that morale is one of the most important key factor as a military officer that we have to pay attention to.
Right, so you're bringing your understanding of morale from the way that it's understood and practiced in U.S. military forces and bringing that into examining the Myanmar conflict. And so then taking it a step further from the development of morale, what are the implications of what good morale versus bad morale as a team of soldiers, how that impacts what they're actually doing on the ground in terms of what they can and can't do?
Yeah. Well, morale, one of the things, you know, to keep morale up of your troops is they feel like they're fighting for, you know, something bigger, right? Something bigger ideas, bigger ideals. And then also second is they have a trust between the soldier and the officer, right? The leaders that is being led. So all these things goes into the soldier willing to do what is needed to get things done, and at times lay down your life for your buddies and your troops. So that's why we pay attention. And I think you and I talked about a little bit about Slim, right? William Slim, in World War II, he got kicked out of Burma, and then by Japanese, and then in order for him to come back, he said it was not the firepower, it was the morale, right? Because when he got kicked out, actually his soldier morale was really, really low, you know, and then he has to rebuild them. And then he attributed to that was the key element that win back Burma. So these are historical example, but also I personally have seen it, you know, with my soldiers. So it's really, really important to winning mission, winning, you know, battles. Is key is your soldiers' morale. Yeah.
Yeah. You said that you've seen personal examples with your soldiers. Can you give examples of that?
During first Gulf War, I was at the very tactical level, so I was directly leading soldiers, and we were moving ammunition, and you know it was. I don't know if I want to tell the entire story, but it was my soldiers' morale that got us, we broke record in moving ammunition. Mm. My platoon moved more ammunition than the whole company. Mm. And it was because they felt like I care for them, right? And I took care of their welfare. I was really very concerned with their safety. I will never allow them to do anything that is safe. And if I see there's unsafe act, I will risk sometimes my commander's wishes, mm-hmm. I would go against it to shut down the mm-hmm. operation. Mm-hmm. So when they saw that, they were like, well, our lieutenant really care about our well-being. So then when I asked them to do a lot, they did. You know, and also one of the thing was, when as a second lieutenant, you know, I don't know much about ammunition other than I learned in books.
Yeah.
You know, so my soldier, my platoon sergeant, he was 40 years old, Vietnam vet. You know, he was my dad's age, you know, I was, but I'll rank him and I was responsible for making the mission accomplishment. So I would do a lot of logistic and all the resources that they need to do their job. And then once I'm done with it, I would jump in like any other soldier and then I'll just start helping, you know, working on the ground. And I think that they felt like I was, you know, I was leading my example, right? I was not asking them to do things that I wouldn't do myself.
Yeah.
So I think that also, they said, motivated them. They said, sometimes I keep on going. And they said, well, our little lieutenant is doing it, so we can't stop either until she stops, you know?
Yeah. That's a great tangible example. And I think people listening to this in whatever professions they're in, from organizations, family units, whatever, I think they can find their own examples from their experience that show what happens when there's that cohesion and that, as we're calling it, morale. Certainly for those who follow professional sports teams, you hear about that a lot in mm-hmm. terms of what the coach is doing to bring a certain morale into getting the best out of his players that is taking shape. And I think, and I'm also recalling, you know, I've read a number of Vietnam Vietnam War era books, and one of the things that stood out, a thread that I remember seeing from some of them, was the sense that there were some units where there were individual soldiers who personally did not like each other and sometimes even detested each other, but they would die for each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's kind of a contradictory feeling of someone like myself who's never been in conflict. I can read it and I can understand it, but I can't personally really know what that's like when in how morale is a cohesion that brings together willing to risk life for someone that you can't even sit down at a table with to share it to break bread. Yeah.
That's right. It's like brothers, you know, you fight with each other, but if your brother get, picked on, you'll come to their side, right? So that type of dynamics going on. And then also says bigger than self, ideal, you know, the ideas that we're fighting for. So those place into the mix. Yeah.
Right. And I also want to go back and underscore Slim. So William Slim was the British general who was commanding the British troops in, at that time, colonial Burma. And the British had really vastly underestimated the Japanese forces and what has now been seen as kind of racist ideology of thinking that no Asian troop could possibly beat these this formidable British presence. But they were summarily, you know, kicked out of Burma. They were famously the long trek from Burma walking through jungles into India. There are numerous accounts of how arduous this journey was and just having their, you know, butts beaten by the Japanese. And when they were back in India, in Slim's famous book, Defeat into Victory, he spends an enormous amount of time talking about his strategies of being in India and looking to take back Burma there in World War II. And he does talk about tactics and strategy and battle and such, but what really stood out to me when I read it, and it's a very big book, 500 pages or so, a very, very detailed analysis of the war and conflict and taking back over Burma. He spends so much time talking about the morale and talking about how he had realized that his troops had come to see these Japanese forces as these like superhuman jungle warriors that just simply could not be defeated. And they just had this mindset of the Japanese as this is, you know, lurking in the jungles and hiding in the shadows and able to live off the land in the way that they had never had to. And so he spends a lot of the book talking about how he starts to build up his troops' morale, first in the training that they're doing in India, and then in the cohesion that he's bringing together before they actually do anything to go back into India. And then as they start to, or back into Burma, as they start to go back into Burma, he sets up very easy wins, skirmishes where he knows that they're certainly going to win, right? To show them that even if in one place you're able to beat a Japanese troop, it gives you the confidence, as you say, that like, oh, they're not superhuman. We can do this. And then as that morale starts to build, then eventually they take back over Burma and kick the Japanese all out. But this is a, you know, a Burmese example and a historical example of one of the more noted and famous generals of World War II, talking about how morale was the central piece of regaining their confidence to beat an opposing army. So there's this, you know, enormous historical and also relevant kind of precedent that we're calling upon.
Yeah. Historic example, but it's based on human, you know, human behavior, right? Yeah. Human mindset. So what was really true for the Slim and his troops is kind of true still today. You know, because they all humans, and human behave based on their motivations and, you know, morale, right? So it's still true today.
So let's talk about today. Let's talk about, as someone, as yourself, coming from a military background, what are you seeing as the morale is played out from the opposing forces, the Burmese military, the different ethnic armed groups, and the PDFs, and those that you've come in contact with or seen from a distance?
Yeah. I want to start with some of the Western analysts, you know, that military, you know, security analysts that are really evaluating what's happening with the Myanmar conflict. And they're great analysts, you know, but I think that if you've never led troops before, you really don't understand or put emphasis on that morale part of the battle, you know, or what's happening. So I think they discounted a lot. And I think that discount or less the lack of emphasis on that. Really, at the outset, they said, you know, when the coup happened, they said, oh yeah, military just too big to fail, you know, the people just don't have enough firepower to get it back. But they really discounted people's will and their motivation, right? The morale, they completely rejected the military, and they just so against, you know, the military, not only against military, but they were never again, right? This is our last battle. This is our last battle. So that got them through, you know, lack of firepower. They started with muskets, you know, now their, you know, military is on the run, right? Military only owns, can control now a fifth of the country territorially. And the opposition coalition side control 40, double the amount, you know, and of course the remaining 40 is being contested. And a lot of the, you know, majority of the border area, right, international borders are under the control of the coalition, you know, not under the military anymore. So, and military continue to still have, you know, firepower, help, you know, provided by the Russians and the, you know, the Chinese, whereas nobody ever come to help the opposition or the resistance side. But, you know, what is the difference? It's the morale. On the military side, the morale is at the, I mean, at the bottom. Because, one, they no longer have the purpose, right? The big mission or the big ideal. What are they fighting for? They're fighting to keep a group of, you know, a small group of people in power who has themselves oppressed them.
Yeah.
Right? If you're a frontline soldier, you don't get enough ration, your family didn't get paid, you don't get, you know, all that stuff. Whereas meanwhile, they're living in palace. All the leaders, you know, military leaders and cronies are living in palace, and barely they could even have food and water in the front line. And they don't care about their families. So that's really is a morale killer. And then, but on the people side, you know, I go around and I talk to, you know, PDFs, say, ethnic groups, and they are still absolutely determined. And they said, this is our last fight. This is our last fight.
Even nearly 5 years on, you're still hearing it.
5 years on. No, yeah, it's absolutely, they're still really highly motivated. And highly motivated soldier has such a big asset. It's, I would say, biggest asset for a military unit.
So this is being underestimated, in your opinion?
Yes, I think they're underestimated largely. And that's why they all, yeah. But, you know, I don't fault them. You know, they may not have led troops, and, you know, I have a different perspective because I've led troops.
And I think this is something that's also being largely missed in the Myanmar story, especially by non-Burmese-speaking media. And we've had guests on our platform, both Burmese and foreigners that are on the ground there. And one of the things that they've emphasized, which I've not really heard in other context or other reporting, is they talk about the sense of joy. They say that, I really wish you could be on the ground and feel the sense of joy and camaraderie and good feeling that's among these groups. And I think when that's a little hard for us to, for those of us to imagine or understand that are a bit removed, because we hear about the airstrikes and the, you know, the Russian influence and the atrocities and everything and just the hardships and everything else. And so I think that's something that can be overlooked among all these other devastating stories that are coming up.
I don't know if I would say joy, but when I have spent time with those guys, right, they had this sense of brotherhood, a sense of camaraderie, right? We're in it together. And because humans are social animals, right, that brings a lot of, you know, comfort and strength for each other. Right, when they come together. So I see that. But also, but that is another piece, is that I think Burmese people, to include, when I say Burmese and Myanmar, people that live in Myanmar, they have a lot of sense of humor. And I think that there's a whole ecosystem in the Burmese speaking world that is happening. And I don't see that in Ukraine environment. it's just all these comedians, mm-hmm. they're just so funny. And that keep them also, you know, the opposition, the resistance forces motivated, as well as it's just very funny, very funny. It's like there's people like Sandy, Bausi, I think there's something like Yatia Sapier, something like that. I mean, they're just making fun of me online. They're making fun of me online, but they're making fun of, you know, the military, the absurdity of what they're saying, right? They do one thing and they, like, right now they've been pushing out, oh, we're trying to, you know, bring peace, right? But on one hand, they've been bombing, right? The relentless bombing. And those guys point those out in a very funny way. And then there's also a whole group of young men, young people that has a, the influencer, they continuously, you know, provide that motivation, reaction, pointing out the absurdity, and also, and each of them like at least 500,000 view every day, right? So there's a whole ecosystem on the and then you have all these former combatant, you know, the defectors, and they also are providing the insight into what military is thinking, military is doing. And so all that's happening. And that's also another piece of defectors. Defectors provided a lot of insight into the Myanmar military. Not only intelligence, but also insight, right? And then people are able to reuse it. Because this, in this particular uprising, particular revolution, I mean, unprecedented number of, large number of defection. So that provided a lot of insight and intelligence to the resistance forces, and that gave them advantage.
Yeah, I think that ecosystem is really fascinating also to talk about, because there's a way that this is being understood within Burmese language, obviously, in those environments, and then those that are getting their access of information outside of Burmese language in various forms and formats in English. And as we talked about before, this reminded me of those early days after the protest with the memes, and that there were a lot of signs that were being held that some of the foreign audience didn't quite understand, because the memes were so creative and inventive, and it would take so long to unpack them. They related to different sayings or expressions or metaphors that every Burmese would know, but just needed to be unpacked to be able to understand how you were using this particular piece of language to describe this particular event that just happened. And so also with this ecosystem of commentaries and influencers and comedy and, you know, everything else, I think there's a lot there that needs to be unpacked. And I also think this can't be underestimated. I think that this is a new form of media, a new form of expression, a new form of engagement, and that there really is a way to carry a message and to influence people through this. And so I wonder if you can get a bit more granular in terms of this ecosystem in ways that those of us have not seen or accessed or understood, and give us a few examples that stand out of the kind of inventive and insightful, creative, humorous, etc. way of engagement that this ecosystem is operating.
Yeah, that whole ecosystem is also a key to keeping people mobilized and motivated, right? Mobilized and motivated. So for example, there was a two comedian, Bausi and Sandy. They started doing uncle and nephew pair. And they pretend like the uncle is the, you know, one of the military leaders, you know, that working for Myanmar. And then the Bausi is the young officer, have to go in a daily briefing of, you know, what's happening on the ground. And he would, you know, they would actually get the real news, real information, but they would like put the absurdity of it. And then they would say how many people die, right, from the military, how many kill in action that day. And they would come up with so many different ways to say they were killed in action in a very funny way, right? So you're just like, you're in stitches because they're just so funny. And And people watch, people listen to it. There was like a million, you know, 900,000 every day. People are looking for that in 20 minutes. And I was told that military will start watching them because they're not really getting real information from their own channel because of corruption. People don't report exactly what's happening. They always send the good news. Mm. But they would start watching this pair to get the real data. Mm. Because these guys are using real data, but they put it in a funny way, and people just love it, right? So everybody look forward to them every morning. And I myself, I do that too. Yeah. I'm getting ready in the morning, and I have their act going on in the background. Yeah.
Right. So So I guess all this then brings to question, we've looked at the way that the resistance side, both in and out of the country, has been keeping up the morale and keeping and sustaining themselves to keep up the effort. From the military side, the picture that you paint, and certainly what we hear otherwise, one is left to wonder, how are they even hanging on this long when their own soldiers are being so suppressed and so unhappy? The morale is so low. They're not getting the right information. They're being put in hostile environments where they're hated every day, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We could go on. Obviously, there's the technical advantage that have, but that can't be the only reason. What's your thought as to why they're despite these obstacles, the military is still the force that it is?
Right. Well, military is able to leverage the international system, right? Yeah. International system of needing visas and passports and all that, right? So the opposition, you know, they have to flee. So some of them don't even have the passports. Yeah. And so they're able to impede on international travel to advocate for Burma, Myanmar, right? So that's one of the reason also that we don't hear too much about it, because they play the international system, even like latest thing, right? Mm-hmm. With President Trump sending Myanmar letter on with the tariff announcement, so they were able to use it, and they've been spinning and saying that is he's a legitimate leader type of thing. Yeah, so that's one. And then, of course, China and, Russia helping them with weapon. And also even the neighboring countries, to a degree, they're bounded by international rules and, tradition, that they won't engage. They engage more with the NAPIRO than with the NUG type of thing. So that impede on some of the resistance ability to maneuver in the system. Another thing is, of course, they have a lot of money. They have money, and they use that. And what else would they have as an advantage? Oh, yes, they've had several people that are Western trained, Western educated, but they are able to present themselves as some type of neutral analyst. And I think those people are a lot more dangerous than the Myanmar themselves. And they have infiltrated into various Western government and think tanks, and so they kind of make the international community confused.
They sanitize.
Spin, right? They take a little bit of truth and then they will spin it. So then for those governments and people that are not paying them attention to Myanmar, and they seem right, and then so it kind of muddy the water. So when somebody like regular analysts are providing real true situation, and those guys come along and acting like they are really neutral analysts, and then they will muddy the water, right? So then oh, it's so complex, and that's like, oh, Burma is so complex, we better not do anything, it's safe not to do anything. But in fact, it is complex, but if you pay attention, there are many areas that you can really intervene or, entry points.
Yeah. And this is where I'd like to give a shout out to Ana podcast. They used to do podcast episodes on Burma. I think they haven't done that recently, but they've shifted to taking articles that English articles that appear in Western periodicals that are, as you say, presenting a certain kind of sanitized picture. But what's for those that are in the know, what's especially interesting about the articles that are being written is what they leave out and what they and the way that they write things. And they will take these articles, these suspect articles, and they will break down paragraph by paragraph what is being missed, the assumptions that are being made, the misinformation, the choice of words. I mean, this is a conflict where, and Myanmar's always been this way, Myanmar, Burma has always been this way, of what words and what terminology are you actually using, that they will break down what the stories they're telling and the words they're using to indicate a certain kind of version, which differs from the actual reality of it, and as you say, muddies the water. So I definitely want to give a shout out to listeners to check out what Ana is doing and breaking down some of these faulty articles, we could say.
Yeah. So many of them will try to do a false equivalency.
Right.
Oh, both sides.
Yes, yes.
Oh, both sides killing. I'm like, it drives me crazy because it's not about both sides.
Yeah.
If military has been bombing a school on purpose, right? It's not an indiscriminate killing. It's very targeted killing. Targeted killing of children. Targeted killing of, you know, an innocent civilian. Because, you know, they, you know, one of the interview, I think it was in Al Jazeera, their spokesperson, Zomento, but everybody call him Zomelo, like a black little ball. Again, the funny Burmese humor. But he specifically said that he was asked that bombing of the school, and he said that pretty much he said it's justified because they thought there was a PDF in there, and there was nowhere, PDF was nowhere
near it, right?
So you think it's okay to kill the children if they suspect, not even confirm, there was a PDF, People Defense Forces in there. So, you know, it's not about the same. So they never call out specifically the military stop bombing. They would say, oh, both sides should stop the violence, right? And then the other day, oh, well, you know, they were talking about some of the PDF human rights violations. Yes, you have in war, right? You have these isolated rogue element on the, you know, the resistance side or the revolution side, but it's not systematic.
Yeah.
On the military side, that is their mode of operation, operandum, right? It's systematic.
Yes.
They use rape. They use burning of villages. They target civilians. It's their, you know, normal way of doing business, right? On the, you know, the resistance side, you will have the rogue element, you know, a unit, but most of the time it's a, you know, a small group of people doing that. And it's not condoned. And then in with giving NUG limitation, you know, they still try to address that. Military never address anybody. All the killing. They never once addressed that. So it's not, but they try to present this group of people, you know, that it, wolf in sheep clothing, trying to present it as both sides.
Yeah. And I know another part of this that you've been engaged in, which I just referred to a little bit a little while ago, is this sense of terminology and use of language, and that language uses can just by using a certain term can give an indication of positive, neutral, or negative. And so can you give, and I know that you've tried to call attention to certain words and being how they're used. In some ways, this has been taken up by the larger movement. For example, Tatmadaw is not a word we hear so much anymore. We hear alternatives for that. Civil war is another one that's been broken down. Shadow government is another one that's been called into question. Can you also break down other words that you've been trying to call attention to?
Those are the key words. And then, of course, the resistance forces or revolutionary forces, instead of, they call it rebels. you know. And then back to the word civil war. Civil war made it sound like two groups of people fighting,
yes.
right?
Mm.
But here it's not civil war. I would say internal conflict is more, I think, more descriptive, because everybody mm-hmm. fighting against this one small group of dictator,
yeah.
right? The violent criminal gang, really. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons we don't call Temido, which is a very honorable,
yeah.
You know, honorific,
yeah.
Yeah, honorific feel to it.
Yeah.
But it's no longer that. It's not a, not only it's not only professional military. It's not a it's not a professional military anymore, and it has become more of a militant criminal gang,
mm-hmm.
and they behave like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the rank or the Demiro, which is for a very professional, you know, honorable organization, and also the ranks, you know, people call General Mayon, like, I never call him mm-hmm. anymore, because that his behavior and mm-hmm. his, you know, characteristics are not of a general, right?
Yeah.
So we don't call him General Mayon anymore,
right?
So that type of stuff, yeah.
Right. So then, as we're talking about like morale, which relates to messaging, we've been talking about some of the messaging that's happening in Burmese language between diaspora and those that are on the ground in the resistance and revolutionary forces. And we've talked about the use of words and how that relates to messaging. Another part of messaging is narrative. And this is something very important to me, because I think this is what our platform is so invested in, is this act of storytelling, this ability to move beyond pure facts and figures of an information dump and be able to weave them into a compelling narrative, which as we're speaking in English, we're speaking to an English-speaking crowd, even though many of our listeners are Burmese, but speaking in English, being able to put these things together to tell a story. And so if we back up and look overall at some of the overall messaging that has taken place, whether we're looking at activist groups, diaspora groups, NUG, policymakers, academics, whatever it is, when you look at the messaging and the narrative that's being told in English from about what's going on in Myanmar to the wider international community, what are your thoughts on how that messaging and narrative structure is taking place as a means of informing and also bringing engagement?
Yeah. I think that the messaging have been largely, Myanmar as a basket case, right? It's complex, it just, you know, can't be solved. Or the people are just victims.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a story of amazing resiliency
mm-hmm.
and creativity and, you know, they did this something that is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like I said earlier, people always say, the people can't, you know, resist the military. Military will win again because of the firepower wise,
yeah.
right? Most of the PDFs, even in some of the ethnic armed groups organization, the new soldiers are like my kids'
mm-hmm,
age,
mm-hmm.
right? 20 something.
Mm-hmm.
They were playing video game, you know, the day before
mm-hmm.
the coup, and then now they are. You know, they have to be a freedom, you know, the resistance fighter. But now, imagine if after 4 years, mm-hmm. military losing almost every battle on the ground.
Yeah,
right?
Amazing.
Amazing, right? What an amazing story.
I know, right?
Yeah. They came up with modifying these agricultural drones,
mm-hmm.
right? And the military tried to shut down all the communication. They figure out a mm-hmm. workarounds to it. And then they're using their social media
yeah.
to mobilize
yeah.
people, provide technical assistance,
yeah.
warning people, all kinds of
mm-hmm.
stuff. What an amazing
yeah.
story, right?
Right?
This is resiliency, mm-hmm. human ingenuity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Human spirit
yeah.
is there, and I wish that we can talk more about that,
mm-hmm.
what the Myanmar people of Myanmar has done.
Why aren't we then?
Yeah, exactly, right? So
yeah.
Whenever I talk to people on the ground, I'm just awed.
Yeah.
I'm just inspired.
Yeah.
And you know, also the diaspora. You know, there's another one that people have discounted. Mm. A lot of the military analysts, they're only looking inside. Diaspora, outside, is also a part of the fight.
Yeah.
They are providing technical assistance, right? Mm-hmm. They provide the international support. They're providing money, mm-hmm. right? So, and they provide morale. Mm-hmm. People feel like, oh, people outside are still helping us. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you a story. When I went to, last few years, I was going and doing town hall meeting throughout United States, as well as in, you know, Japan, Korea, Australia, Europe. Mm. And everywhere I go, I see a lot of people of all generations. Mm. You know, my parents' generation, my generation, my kids' generation, they're all there. Mm. And all these old lady will come up to me, and they're supporting. Mm. Old lady. And specifically, I remember in New York, in Queens, this lady, she's 82 or something like that, and she makes food, and she sells every weekend, and the money that she gets, she donates to the PDF, right? Mm-hmm. And the day I saw her, she made shrimp curry, and she bought shrimp, and then she peeled shrimp and then made curry, right? Mm. And she has arthritis. It was the winter time, right? Wow. And with her arthritis hand, she peeled all that shrimp, right? Shell, de-shell them, and then she made that. And she has been doing that since the coup, right? Since the resistance started. Wow. And she came to me, that's all I can do with the meat, right? But, you know, but she does it every... And for her, she's an American citizen now. She's too old to travel. She will never benefit from the Burma independence.
Yeah, right.
Right? The democracy that will arrive. But to her, she said, that's the inheritance that she wanted to give back to them. I mean, she is the typical of a lot of the... you know, older generation that are doing.
That's amazing to hear. And I think that, that again, these are stories of happening within the diaspora's relationship to the revolutionary forces. But then it's another matter, the communication and the narrative from the diaspora or the NUG to the international community, where, because, you know, frankly speaking, we're not getting this message so much. We're or this is coming out in some channels, but there is, and I think you could find, I think it might be in some cases the exception proves the rule. Like, I think you could point to the Chin community in Indiana and the amazing work they've been doing with lobbying. Or I was just in Oslo, and the work of the Oslo diaspora and amazing. Some of those people were just really stood out as something special and bridge building and making those connections. But in other cases, and we talked about this before, sometimes when there has been a prominent international audience, there has been a story of victimization, and there's been a real leaning in to the devastation of this victimization. And so I wonder your thoughts are, what are the dangers of when you have that international audience and that forum to speak, and you lean into a story of victimization as you build the narrative rather than of resilience and strength? What do you think are the reasons that story is being told instead of the other? And then what are the dangers of doing so?
Right. So when you're so victimized, right, you know, and then over time people get fatigued, you know, the donor fatigue type of thing, right? And when is it going to end, right? It's a human nature I've seen, I've observed, is that people don't like to help people that are not helping themselves, right? And also people like winning teams.
Yeah.
More you win, more they will come in and, you know, support you, right? Losing team don't get the support. So I think that the fact that now the resistance forces has control 40, double the territory compared to the military, that story doesn't get told.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And people know, hey, look at the Burmese people. Without any help from anyone, with them and diaspora, has kicked the crap out of the military so far, right? And if you wanted to just help a little bit, we can get to the end state faster. And the thing is, I think that they don't need any help from anybody if China and Russia is not helping to the military, right? They could have done it already. Actually, sure. I think we would have seen the end state already if China didn't jump in and then, you know, created all this, created all the support for the military after the 1027, Operation 1027 at the end of, 2023, right? Yeah. Mm. So they would have, I think, gotten it already, but it just, China got in the way. Yeah. But I think that China is going to find out that no amount of help from China will ever put military back together.
Yeah. Yeah.
This Humpty Dumpty is not going to be put back together.
Right.
Because of the, back to the morale, right? It's rotting from inside. All the corruption within the military is crushing their people's morale. So that's why they had to go out and do this forced conscription, right? Which, where they have to abduct people, right? To pull into the military. You know, abducted soldier is not an effective fighting soldier.
No.
You know what I mean? So, and all the, you know, they don't care about their people. People, the soldiers know that the leadership don't care about them. So why would they fight for them, right? And then these, all this corruption is eating away all the supplies and all the resources. So for example, you will have 10 killed in action in the front line. The commander will only report two, and then, but he will still collect 10-person salary and pocket eight. But meanwhile, you have no idea that you don't have 10 soldiers. You know, so any given moment in Naypyidaw, they probably don't know how many people they have. And if you don't have that, you can't fight.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So right now, these abducted soldiers are just a bullet stopper in the front line. That's it, you know. They don't really care. They don't expect them to survive. It's just using those bodies to waste ammunition of the revolutionary forces. That's it.
Right.
They know they're going to die. They get pushing them out. They don't care if they die.
Yeah.
They just stretch.
And then going back to how we started this conversation with morale, that's also one of your arguments, as we talked about before this recording, that you felt that while some of the security analysts that you were reading might be correct in describing, you know, some of the tactical and the tactical losses, we could say, of the resistance forces, what they were discounting was where morale plays into that. In other words, that yes, you might have this loss, this, we're not discounting or sugarcoating what this loss means and how it's not what was expected and it's devastating and you have to regroup, but after that, the thing that's being missed is that when you have the morale, it allows you to push beyond. You have a plan B, you have a plan C, you have a plan D. And so you're constantly able, and because you see it as a last battle, you're constantly able, and you have the camaraderie of your brothers that you're fighting with, you have the ability to be able to look at, okay, we'll pick ourselves up. We've done this a million times again. What do we do next? What do we do next? Whereas the morale not existing, as you've laid out in so many ways with the military, that with the morale not existing on the other side, that that you can't just look at this kind of messy conflict battlefield alone. You also need to look at where the morale is playing into the different sides and different factors, and that's the part that's being missed.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. And I think certainly we could look at examples like Afghanistan and Vietnam, where there have been massive advantages from one side that is, you know, underestimated, or even, I don't know, maybe even Iraq, you know, of where there have, where things have not progressed to the point that the greater force would have liked because of this underestimation of those that had
people's will. Yeah, people's will.
Right.
And the morale. So even like in, you know, for China, you know, it's surprising that they don't think about that.
Yeah, right.
Because Kuomintang, KMT, got all the help from the America, United States. But it's the people will that wins the day.
Yeah.
You know, so if China will think back and like their own history, like, scratch, you know, their head. And so like, maybe we're on the wrong side of history right now.
Yeah.
Or maybe we're betting on the losing horse,
right?
So, like I was saying, the diaspora and the another group of people that are really critical in this fight is the involvement of women. Unusual amount of women are involved. In the past revolution, if you have like 5 or 10%, we would be very, very lucky. But now our data is showing like nearly half is women. So all their talents, you know, their capabilities are coming into play. And it has to do with the, I think, during the 10 years of Myanmar democratic transition, a lot of aid packages came into Myanmar with the women empowerment piece, women peace and security type of thing. And that really opened the eyes of the Burmese Myanmar women, you know, people of Myanmar, the women. And also they got the training and, you know, education to have the capacity. So when the, this, you know, this after coup happened, they feel like they don't want to go back to the day of, you know, where military dominance, male dominance, and then also they feel like this is relevant to them, and they think they can do this, right? They have the capacity to do this. And so that also play into the equation, you know, when you're comparing to the previous, the uprising and then the current Spring Revolution, is that mix as well. I think this, that cannot be discounted either. The involvement of women in there. Yeah. And then also more women involved. I think we need to have more women at the decision maker level and the, at the table. After we win the war, we got to win peace.
Yeah.
And we know from many studies when women are involved in the, at the table, peace table, then the peace, you know, is a higher chance of getting that peace, and the it is also long lasting.
Do you think the men on the revolutionary side are ready for that from what you've seen?
Well, I think that they're still struggling. You know, it's very, because it's a cultural what would you call it? It's a cultural
way of thinking.
Yeah, way of thinking, barriers.
Yeah.
Because when men and women came in together and they got the trainings together, right, at the outset of the revolution, but so now they're becoming trained, you know, resistant fighters. And it's the men that ended up going to the, you know, battles. And women are like, hey, we want to go. And they will say, no, 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 you stay back. Or you take care of the, you know, rations or supply. But they're men, women that really wanted to be a real soldier. And many of them left the revolution because they got frustrated. Because they want, they joined the fighting force because they want to be soldier, but they got trained together. But then when the time comes, and I keep on telling the men, you know, you lost a very valuable soldier.
Absolutely.
I mean, this motivated soldier, right? It's just, you lost a lot. So what our data was showing, we, at the beginning, outset, there was 65% of the movement was women, and we're down to 37.
Wow, that's a huge loss.
Yeah, huge loss, right? Yeah. Still higher than previous, but that's a lot of loss of labor and talents.
Yeah, and no reason for it, really.
Yeah, right. So we really need to do a better job in integrate more women into it, not because it's a, you know, something ethical or whatever, but it's actually real. It's if we want to win, if we want to win peace, we even more than need them more. So, you know, there are a lot of groups that are doing women empowerment, women peace and security, and I really appreciate it. I think it needs to. But those programs work at, with women, you know, trying to get their capacity up, their empowerment. But we also need to work with men. We need to create a whole army of men champions.
You know,
who will help work together side by side with the women to break these barriers, right? Social barriers and cultural barriers.
How can that be done?
So when you're working at the, these gender workshop, it's gender. It didn't say women, right? So then bringing both men and women together and help them, you know, increase the capacity to change the these not very useful cultural barriers. So whenever we think about gender, they they think of men versus women, mm-hmm. right? But I want people to think more men and women, mm-hmm. right? And women. Mm-hmm. They come from a different perspective sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we want the difference make. And we know from the many studies, right, when we have men and women working together, those teams are a lot more smarter. Mm-hmm. And not because there's a saying, like, if you want a team to be smarter, just add women. And in that particular case, it's not because women are smarter than men. Actually, when women come into the team, they just bring different perspective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then you have more options.
Right, right.
If you can't work, you know, if all men just work looking at the option one, then when you add women to it, then you start to have option two, three, four, and like, oh, okay, if we can achieve it with option one, we can go to option two, option three.
Of course.
So that's why it becomes quote unquote smarter.
Yes.
But it's not because women are smarter.
Right.
You just have more options.
Right.
So in a complex system, you know, the what's happening in Myanmar is a very, you know, it's a complex system with multi-dimension. So when you have women coming into the decision maker level, you know, you start to see different angle, different, you know, domain, different. So if you can't get if you can solve the issue from this one domain, then you have more option to solve it. So I think that, more of it just doing just women training, I would say men and women training together.
Right, right.
So when I have to give training now, some people will ask me for training, I will always say, I want men and women.
Nice.
I wouldn't do just all men or all women. I'll do men and women.
And how is that? How do you find that?
It's difficult.
Really?
It's difficult.
How so?
Yeah. But I would, you know, because of... especially when we started out 65% women. So I said, you know, I want to see my team, the people that I'm training to be 50-50 men and women. Now it's down to 37%. So I'm back to like, okay, I need at least 30% to be women.
So as you bring these women into the training room and try to and make sure that there is some representation there, you mentioned some difficulties that you face in that situation. What's the nature of those challenges?
Yeah, so you have to kind of teach them different way to listen to each other. So, for example, men, because women see the environment differently than men. When women bring something up, the men will say, like, what is she talking about, right? There's nothing to do with anything, right? But it may be, that's their blind spot.
Because
it's their blind spot, they're not saying the same thing as they are. They would dismiss it. But that may be the key.
Right.
So I'll go back to Osama bin Laden, right? What I my understanding of this whole thing is that there was a, in the compound that Osama bin Laden was living in, you know, Pakistan, the first thing they realized was the milk consumption, right? The amount of milk that being delivered didn't jive with how many people that would be living there, right? And we know, and then we know that there was Osama bin Laden many wives. So that's why he has many children. So understanding the milk situation, right? And that would be the most men may not have, think about milk, right? But I think that, I'm not sure it's a woman or not, but you know, that something like that, right? To paying attention to something that seemingly unrelated, but that may be the key.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Same thing with the the India's space program. I don't know if you've heard of it. When it went to the I think it was to Mars. Yeah, Mars program. I'm not an engineer, so I may not describe it accurately or as well. But my understanding was, you know, they had a rocket. When they cleared the atmosphere, it keep on burning, right? To clear it, they had to put extra boost into the rocket, and it just too much power, and it ended up burning the vessel. And it was all men working together mm-hmm. to do that. And there was female engineers, but they weren't really allowed to, you know, make decision and get involved. But eventually, after several fails, this one woman, like, pushed herself to, you know, get people to listen. What her theory was, they call it Puri theory. She was cooking Puri with her daughter. And, you know, Puri, mm. I guess you have to have the oil really hot. Mm. And then you put the Puri in and you turn it off. Because if you don't turn it off, then Puri got burned, mm. right? So that was her thing.
That's
so the
incredible.
Rocket, right? So she's yeah. thinking that, like Puri, mm. if once it's clear mm. it, then we got to turn off.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they try that and it was successful.
Amazing. Amazing.
A Mars wow. or wherever they made it to.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, but that was, you know, about different experience. You mm. know, most men may not cook Puri, so they may not understand mm. it. But she's cooking Puri, and that's what came into her mind. Mm. Like, hey, we're burning the Puri.
Wow. You know, it reminds me of reading about some of the history of anti-Semitism in Europe. And where I'm going with this is that the exclusion of Jews in many of those European countries. And I might have my facts wrong. I read about this a while ago. But my memory is that at some point, France started to allow Jews more participation in the country, but not from a volition or a motivation of wanting to be progressive or wanting to be inclusive or, you know, just having these high-minded ideals, simply for the realization and the fact that you have this entire population of people. And, you know, as we say, it's not that there's one type of people or gender or background that is more intelligent. It's that they bring different things in. And of course, you know, Jews famously have been talented at certain kinds of, you know, business and other occupations back then. And so, you know, having a whole subset of a community that was not allowed to participate in a country's activity was, you know, what is that going to do for the economy, whether it's women or whether it's Jews or something else? And so it was, while there was kind of a mixed feeling historically in terms of, you know, the some aspects of anti-Semitism and some ceilings in terms of what the Jewish community could do, they did allow more inclusion based on, you know, pure economics than other countries, and then benefited as a result of this, because of course you're bringing this community in. If we expand the thinking from looking at, you know, where and how women are included, and looking at that Jewish example, where, well, obviously the number one thing that comes up in Myanmar is the Rohingya,
yeah.
and the 1 to 1.5 million displaced mm-hmm. people that are in Bangladesh, and thinking about, you know, looking at this not just from doing the right thing or being progressive, or if you want to use the charge word, being woke, mm-hmm. you know, looking at it not just from this perspective, but looking at it from if you just simply see that different individuals and members of communities brings different skills and gifts and talents, what are you doing to your aims of your society and what you're trying to build if you're excluding all of this talent and all of this potential of what people are willing to offer? I mean, how many stories have you heard of Rohingya that have had, you know, medical degrees and teaching degrees and engineering degrees that just have no future? And as terrible as that is on an individual level, to have that level of, you know, that amount of things you can do in life and not be able to, well, just remove that for a moment and look at what you're excluding in society. I mean, how much does Myanmar itself need these skills mm-hmm. and to, based on, you know, biased, racist kind of outlook, to be prohibiting these people with high degrees of skills or potential to develop those skills? You know, it's this broader way of looking of just how you can access the most talents of the most people to be greater than you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, in the U.S., right, that has been the strength is, like, different people, you
yeah.
know, pulling a different talents from different populations,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's what make America, you know, prosper and
yeah.
become the powerful nation. So similarly, yes, and especially in post-conflict Myanmar, you know, right now they were mm. saying, like, birth rates are falling,
mm.
and of course many men would have died
mm-hmm.
in battle. So, you know, they will need the population, you know, all the population they can get for redevelopment.
Mm.
So conflict, post-conflict time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that they should, you know, it will be good to integrate, you know, Rohingya back into the population. They will need that.
So just one final thought as we close, to bring in another element that we talked about in our conversations before this recording. We were looking at how Ukraine is being framed versus Myanmar, and how there's a more obvious connection that the West and especially Europe has made of this buffer against an advancing combination of corruption and oligarchy and authoritarianism and all these other kind of bad things, and that if Ukraine gets lost to this approaching storm, then Europe is coming very soon after. And that it's a similar thing, that in Myanmar you have a country where you don't need to try to convince the people the values of democracy or an inclusive society or progressive progressive society, that to a large part this is already being understood and integrated. They're fighting for these ideals that, is in jeopardy in many other parts of the world.
Eastern Front and Western Front, right? The Ukraine is trying to fight off the authoritarianism in the Western Front, and then Eastern Front is Myanmar, really. Myanmar is the last democracy on the mainland Southeast Asia, right? If Myanmar is gone, then the whole, mainland Southeast Asia, there'll be Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, none of them will be a democracy, and at the, at the southern part of China. I think that people should pay attention, as well as I want people to know that Russian bombs and bullets are killing Burmese as well, Myanmar people as well, not only in Ukraine, but it's over here. And I mean, we've seen, Russian trainers, training the Myanmar pilots inside Naypyidaw and wherever. all these, plane they bought from, Russia are being serviced and, trained by the Russian pilots. So,
Great. Well, it's an interesting thought to end on, and another narrative entry point for how this can start to be framed.
I think that Myanmar is strategically important in Southeast Asia, and they have forgotten because it's the, any major powers that want to control Asia, they always needed Myanmar, right? The British wanted it, the Japanese wanted it. And this moment in time, China is, must have Myanmar in order for it to control Asia. Asia Pacific. So I think people should pay attention to that. And also, the Myanmar story is not a story of victims. It's an amazing resilience human ingenuity and commitment is, playing out there. So I think that, there's a lot of inspiring story if you look.
And I would add that even the French wanted it in the 19th century. They saw it as a key to Asia. So I think as far as you go back historically, I think you find precedents of different powers coming in and seeing it as the key to something to access beyond its own point.
It's a key terrain, key a geographical location, but as well as it's full of natural resources, And Myanmar is one of the large provider of rare earth minerals. It has oil. It has all kinds of minerals like copper and all these special aluminum, even uranium. In addition to a very long coastline, 2,000 kilometers. So all this make Myanmar a very, very key, I think, country. But I think a lot of the Western country has forgotten about it, and that's why I have written many articles and papers and chapters about how Myanmar is a strategic blind spot for the U.S. and the West.
We're glad to have had you with us for this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. You might know that beyond sharing stories and conversations on this platform, we also carry out humanitarian projects through our nonprofit mission, Better Burma. As we all know, the challenges these days are vast,
but so too are the opportunities to provide meaningful support. Your contributions go towards supporting critical initiatives, such as providing food, medical supplies, and basic necessities to internally displaced persons in conflict zones. You can help to fund healthcare services that save lives and bring dignity to those in need. Your generosity also supports education efforts for children, helps mobile medical clinics, and provides care packages to political prisoners, just to name a few of the many programs we sponsor. You can support these impactful efforts and directly contribute to our projects, which uplift and empower those most affected by this crisis in Myanmar. Visit betterburma.org/donation to join us in this mission.
Yarananda, Dayananda, Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,